question. So just mentioned in a short sentence, I believe the Oligina studies was quite important. And I wanted to ask if you had also something explored in your way of getting a bhikkhu about the influence of the Vinaya for the bhikkhu. Because for me it is a little bit like the Vinaya is more or less making the bhikkhu. So
yes, that's a good way of kind of expressing it. I mean, ultimately what distinguishes the bhikkhu from the lay Buddhist is the Vinaya. And the in practicing the Dhamma, studying the Dhamma, practicing the Dhamma, then a lot of the teachings are still not so clear. I have a really comprehensive understanding of them. You begin to see them more clearly. But from the day that we take the Sampada, then our life is governed in most every detail by the Buddha's words themselves. So every rule that we keep was laid down by the Lord Buddha himself. And although we might feel that there's a huge gap, not just historically but spiritually, between ourselves and say Sariputta and Moggallana and all the great arahants, but what we do know is that they kept all these rules, that they lived within the same boundaries, they had the same training of body and speech that we have. So there's a sense of, for me, it gives a sense of lineage, connection, going right back 2,600 years to the time of the Buddha. So it's like a vertical dimension and then horizontal dimension. It's all the well-practicing Theravada monks, whether in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, or wherever, are living life within this structure, within this framework. So, as a lay person, you follow the laws of the land, but the particular laws which affect our life are often the results of economic forces, powerful people taking advantage of weak people. They reflect power balance in society, but our whole structure and the way that we live is created by a fully enlightened Buddha in order to create the most conducive conditions for practice of Dhamma. So this is the essence of Vinaya, is the creation of the most conducive conditions for of samadhi, punya, liberation. I think that one way analogy given for the veneer is of a castle or a storehouse or a treasure house which is surrounded by concentric walls, like fortifications. And so the inner walls are like comparable to the Parajika, and the second ring of wall, the second wall is the Sangati Sesa, and then the outer wall is like the minor rules, the Dukkhitas, the Kova Patipat. And so if you take each of these minor rules out of context, then they can sometimes seem a bit silly or inconsequential, or you know, what's that got to do with anything? But when they're seen within that, you know, within that structure, the idea is that if you keep the minor rules well, you prevent that outer wall being breached. You don't have to worry about the inner wall. If you're very careful in keeping the minor rules, then like the Sanghati Sesa or the Parajika become unthinkable, because even this, you know, you wouldn't think about doing, let alone this, you know. So it's a way of, you don't even get near to the edge of the cliff, you know, you just keep far away from that. So psychologically, by being very precise and being very careful with the minor rules, you cut out a lot of the stress and the worry about keeping the more important rules or the most severe rules. But it's also, you can look at it in terms of culture. It's a monastic culture. And that adds to the richness of life as a bhikkhu. We have our own distinctive, long-established culture. And the Buddhist monastic order is the longest lasting institution of any kind in the world. It's something which has been going 2,600 years without interruption. Oh, I think it's something that I think you've talked about in Vinaya meetings, and it's understanding the relationship between Dhamma and Vinaya, and it's important to reflect on this, particularly in cases where you can find loopholes in some of the Vinaya rules. You know, the tendency is to say, well, actually that's not strictly speaking against the rule, therefore it's okay. But taken in the Dhamma Vinaya together, you say, well, it might not, strictly speaking, be breaking a precept, but it's quite clearly in contradiction with the principles of Dhamma. You know, it is something which is the intention to act or speak in such a way that is coming from an unwholesome into Dhamma, and it will lead to an increase in unwholesome Dhammas. So the fact that it's not technically a violation of the rule is not the only factor to be considered. I think I just talk without the microphone. One point I made when I was first considering becoming a monk, and something that really impressed me as a feature of Vinaya is that there are no exceptions. You know, we don't have this idea that you reach a certain level of spiritual development and now you're beyond reach of law of karma, and everything you do is you know, okay, because you've got a pure mind now. And that the idea that someone who's reached that kind of level can't be judged by conventional standards of morality. So it's like crazy wisdom idea, you know, now you're enlightened, you can get drunk every day and do all these kinds of things, and it's you know, you can't be judged in the way that an ordinary person could. And as you know, in our tradition, someone who's been ordained 30, 40 years, someone who's even fully enlightened, has to keep every single rule that a monk who's just been ordained for a few days has to keep. Not because he has to, necessarily, but as out of respect for the Vinaya, out of respect for the Buddha who laid down the Vinaya, and to be a good example to monks of future generations. It makes it, psychologically, it makes a big difference if you know that, say, Ajahn Mun, you know, kept all the Vinaya rules until, you know, the very end of his life. And although, he was in the great arahant of the modern period, it wasn't the case that it's okay, you don't need to do that anymore, you don't need to do this anymore. So one of the, one of the most shocking lines or passages in all of the suttas is when Brahmin asks, and I actually can't remember whether he asked Sariputta, Moggallana, or anyone else, who he asked, but he said, you know, in this monastery, this is a paraphrase, you know, are there arahants? Yes. Are there anagamis? Yes. Akadagamis? Yes. A lot. Yes, a lot. And then he said, are there any monks here who are unenlightened but believe themselves to be unenlightened? And he said, yes. And I can remember the shock because, you know, the fact that there could be monks who'd be so deluded, even living in a monastery where there are all these great monks, you know, who will surely give them some feedback and tell them, you know, whether that's the power of delusion. And so even in a sort of optimum conditions where you're living in a monastery where the Buddha and with all these great arahants, people were seriously overestimating their spiritual attainment. And so how could, you know, we expect anything less in periods where there are far fewer great teachers around, people on the right track. So given the fact that spiritual overestimation has been a feature of monastic communities, spiritual communities everywhere, forever, having a system in which you consider spiritually developed people is exempt from moral precepts seems to me a very dangerous I couldn't place my trust in such a system. And the Theravada tradition, where everybody keeps the rules whether you need to or you don't, seems to me that the basis for a trustworthy and stable spiritual community. So that was one of the reasons why I really found that the Thai or the Theravada Sangha is something I really wanted to join and be part of.
It's a democracy, kind of.
No, it's not a democracy. I mean, democracies, you know, we have these like different ways of resolving problems and issues in monastic. Monastic order laid down by the Buddha himself, and the democratic process is one out of six or seven, and the democratic process is to be used in cases like trivial matters or time-consuming matters. You know, let's say, shall we have the monks sit at the front and the lay people at the back, or the monks on this side and the lay people, you know, you have like communities and houses and squats where people just spend so much time just arguing about these kind of minor points of procedure. So this is the kind of thing where democracy is, look, let's raise your hand, you know, okay, and that's really, but the Buddha said, if there's any kind of really serious issue, a vote would lead to kind of a schism or a split or really sort of solidify divisions in a community. It's not a good system. And in most of really important things, as you know, you need unanimous decision before anything can be decided. So, democratic process, voting is just one way of dealing with problems in a community rather than the way.
what you probably meant is like an egalitarian system, in that sense that there's nobody exempt from the rules. It's not a like special privilege system, like a feudal system or something.
Oh, I see. So I didn't misunderstood.
But they didn't mean the voting so much, I guess, like it's the word democracy, which says voting.
Yeah, I didn't understand. Because excuse me.
It's a good, good point anyway.
Tanajan, on the previous visit, you've I think mentioned that Unpu Cha would instruct his new monks primarily in Hiriyotapa and Samadhi. I was hoping you could give a bit more specific explanation of that.
More that if you ask any of the monks from, you know, from that period when Ajahn Chah was still teaching, I think they will say that the hours and hours and hours of Dhamma talks that we'd listen to, you know, only quite a small percentage would be meditation based, or in terms of meditation techniques and meditation. That the vast majority of the talks were concerned with Vinaya and with Kawat, the basic understanding of the path, the Eightfold Path, and there was so much detail about the Kawat Patibat. This is used, you hear this again and again, the Kawat Patibat. And so when there was specific instruction on meditation or the more subtle and profound dhammas, and people really were really ready for it. You know, it wasn't like you were just getting this all the time, so you got sort of just inured to it, but it was something really special. But in day-to-day living, the talks are much more sort of practically inclined and mindfulness-based, and mindfulness in all postures, and using Vinaya rules and procedures and conventions to illuminate the movement of the mind and to create harmony in the group, and kind of group energy which is most conducive to practice. And so.